Om okay?
Yeah,
I thought you must have been very sick.
No.
So we've been reading in chapter 5 of Bhagavad Gita, and Krishna is speaking about karma yoga, which means action in Krishna consciousness, or action that's detached from the fruit of one's work. And this is the part that Krishna is describing here is quite an elevated part from the point of view of understanding someone who's purified with transcendental knowledge, as we discussed in the last chapter. Someone who's purified with knowledge and is actually realized, he actually perceives himself as different from his body. He actually perceives himself as an eternal soul, not exactly as consciousness, but as a soul whose symptom is consciousness. He's perceiving in that way. He sees his body moving and acting and doing this and that, but he doesn't think that it's he who is doing it. And he doesn't perceive himself as the actor. He sees that the body is moving by the power, by the force of the three modes of material nature, goodness, passion, and ignorance. But he is aloof from it. So this is quite already an exalted, knowledge-filled understanding or consciousness. And then Krishna is going to explain. In the previous chapter, he's explained how to attain that through transcendental knowledge. But here, we read last time how a person in this consciousness, divine consciousness, although engaged in seeing, this imagine what he's describing here, the type of detached, elevated, realized consciousness this is. Although engaged in seeing, hearing, touching, smelling, eating, moving about, sleeping and breathing, he always knows within himself that he actually does nothing at all. So a complete detachment and realization of the difference between the person and the body. Because while speaking, evacuating, receiving, or opening or closing his eyes, he always knows that only the material senses are engaged with their objects, and he is aloof from them. One who performs his duty without attachment, one who is realizing this, seeing himself so separated, surrendering the results unto the Supreme Lord. So he's acting, but he's not acting with the same motive that an ordinary person will act. He's surrendering the results of his work. He's working for the pleasure of the Supreme Lord. Such a person, so he's unattached, rather than being attached, which most people are. And most people, unless there's something in it for themselves, there's no motivation to work at all. But this person isn't in that consciousness at all. He's completely detached from the body. And he's working, doing his duty, dutifully working, without attachment, surrendering the results unto the Supreme Lord. And he's unaffected by sinful actions. In other words, no matter what he does, the reactions of that do not touch him, do not affect him. Just as the example given, the lotus leaf is untouched by water because the lotus leaf has its very waxy covering on it. So when the water goes onto the lotus leaf, it just falls right off because of the waxy covering on the leaf. So similarly, there's this So what does the wax do? The covering separates the leaf from the water. So there's, practically speaking, actually speaking, no interaction between the water and the leaf. So this person's detachment and his surrendering to Krishna makes no connection between what he does and karma and reactions to what he does. So it's quite astounding. Now here's where we're up to today. The yogi, because these persons, even though they may not be doing asanas and pranayama, but they're abandoning attachment, they are yogis, they are the best yogis. The yogis abandoning attachment act with body, mind, intelligence, and even the senses, but only for the purpose of purification. So in the Sanskrit is kayena manasa buddhi, the body, the mind, and the intelligence. They're acting with these things because Arjuna's desire was to avoid his duty, avoid the battle. He wanted to, practically speaking, run from the battle because he feared what? The sinful reactions and the terrible results of the battle of Kurukshetra. And indeed, he was faced with something so difficult. But Krishna is explaining to him not to run from the battle, not to be inactive, but to act. But on this level, with detachment, with surrender, surrendering the results of the work to Krishna, and even with the senses, even with the body, even with the mind, even with the intelligence, everything, but for the purpose of purification. So, Srila Prabhupada in his purport describes, he knows that he is not this body and that this body does not belong to him. Not only isn't it him, like you have a car and we don't think, oh, I'm the car, but we think the car belongs to us. But not even the body, the car, belongs to us. Such an amazing consciousness to be so detached from the realm of matter. He himself belongs to Krishna, he thinks. Now that's the essence of the point that puts everything in the proper perspective. Either we end up through a gradual process of karma yoga or even later astanga yoga. If we end up at this realization gradually that this body, I'm not my body, my body doesn't belong to me, the body belongs to Krishna. But ending up with the realization, or even starting with the realization that I belong to Krishna. And that's actually where bhakti begins, with this realization that I belong to Krishna. Who am I? I am Krishna's. And then Krishna has given me this vehicle, and being a specific karma and different abilities and different debilities and different nature. My body belongs to Krishna, my nature, my mind, my intelligence, everything is Krishna's because I am Krishna's. Now this brings the consciousness from a point of view of detachment that in one sense is described here. I'm detached, I'm not my body, I'm not attached to the results. I'm working according to the modes. A detachment from the material world. But this brings that to a new level. And the word, Sanskrit word used here is kevalai, is purified. It brings us from the point of view of detached work, which technically can be called nishkam karma, to the point of bhakti. When one is purified to the degree that one not only considers himself, but perceives himself. So much paint. Yeah. Boy, you must really go painting it up. Unless you brought paint for everyone else too.
No.
So you're paint.
Yeah, just different colors. Want everyone to paint?
Huh? Everyone who can paint, we want to paint. But everyone who can paint, we don't want to paint. What were we talking about again? Something about Krishna and Krishna consciousness. Yeah. Huh? What? Yeah, well, that, it's such an incredible... Okay, now you have to be good. And that's where bhakti begins. The process of elevation can begin with knowledge and detachment, etc. But when the process of elevation comes to the point of bhakti, it's when one says, Krishna, I am yours. And that's called saranagati or surrender. And that, which was mentioned before, gotripte varanam tata, that acceptance of oneself is not only a soul, an eternal soul, but as Mama Eva Angsa Jiva Loke, as part of Krishna, or as Krishna's, as we heard in the fourth chapter, that when you realize the truth, you'll see that when you have transcendental knowledge, you see that all living entities are part of me and are mine. So when we accept that and realize that and understand that is our natural position, that I'm Krishna's, and then that internal state of considering oneself Krishna's, called saranagati, or surrender. Surrender is the actual beginning of bhakti, bhakti yoga. One's relationship with Krishna is in its proper perspective at that point. Because at this point, we have our back turned to Krishna. Krishna bhule se jeev, anadiya bahimukh. Bahimukh, is that word in Hindi also? But it's, you understand what it means. Bahimukh means the back turned to Krishna. And then what bhakti, the process of bhakti, or sadhana bhakti, the practice, is the process of going from bahyamukha with our backs turned to Krishna, which is quite insulting. When I talk about this point, I usually do that. I turn my back on everyone and insult everyone. But I won't do it. But Krishna consciousness means the process of turning towards Krishna, facing Krishna. And when we have our back turned to Krishna, it's like we have our back to the sun, and when we look forward, our backs to the sun, we see our shadow. We don't see ourselves properly. We see a false image of ourselves that isn't quite us. And that's material life. We have an image of ourselves. We understand that we are we. We are ourselves, but when we think of who we are, we just see the shadow without the substance of who we are. So when someone is purified to the level of bhakti, he thinks, I am Krishna's. And when we think I am Krishna's, and therefore use, as this verse says, body, mind, intelligence, and even the senses, only for the purpose of purification, only for the purpose of pleasing Krishna, then one naturally has the mood of not only I am Krishna's, but Krishna is mine. That finally, that feeling of belonging, that we belong to, we're in the right place and we belong. That's when that finally comes, when one accepts oneself as Krishna's and surrenders. And now we have so many, subtly or grossly, we have feelings of belonging. But it all is in relationship to the body or the mind. And that's always changing and shifting, so it's always very frustrating. So you belong to, in relationship with your parents, and then they leave this world, and then suddenly you feel, what happened? You know, the things I belong to aren't here anymore. Or I'm in some relationship and I belong to this person and this person belongs to me, and suddenly, boom, it breaks. and part of you feels like it breaks, because we feel, what we do is we invest. What's another word for invest in a sense? You invest our sense of self. We take our sense of self and place it. What's another word for invest? For just anyone?
Repose?
Yeah, repose. Another word for repose. We take our sense of self, this is me, and we place it on something, we give it, invest it, give it, repose it, place it upon something that isn't us, and then we feel it's mine. When we take the sense of me and place it on something external to us, we perceive that thing is mine. But the thing, because this isn't me, then the thing isn't mine, actually. And then, but we feel that. And then when it breaks, we lose part of ourselves. We break. But not really, because it's just we're experiencing the result of the our illusion. And this happens, and you see this all the time, with the people, they're old, and their husband or their wife leaves, and they need, and suddenly they feel they're not all there almost. And what do? They have to invest their sense of self on something or someone else. And what do so often? What do they put it on?
Dog.
Yes, a dog or a cat. I mean, it's so common, because you need someone, feel incomplete by yourself. But it's so dangerous to do that. Because when you do that, when you invest your sense of self, when something is mine, and like that, and you put it on a dog, and then you have so much attachment for a dog, and then you die. And the soul is thinking, and the person is thinking about his dog, and it takes this time on his time. Saditad bhava bharata. This is the principle. So these principles of spiritual life are actually so important, because we govern our lives, even though we're not conscious of it all the time, but we govern our lives, we make our decisions in reference to principles. You know, and different people in different cultures have different principles. So one principle may be that, I'm trying to accumulate as much wealth as I can. It's an obvious principle. I want to stay healthy as long as I can. So these are different principles. But if we have only the principles born of a materialistic culture, then it's going to lead us in a dangerous way. So the Bhagavad Gita gives us principles that are very, very wise, that they're based on knowledge. So bhakti means that sense of self is given to Krishna, I am Krishna. And then automatically, that means the soul, me, I am eternal, and I'm eternally Krishna. Then automatically, if we have that, then everything connected to me, the body, the mind, the intelligence, whatever Krishna has given me, should naturally be used for Krishna's pleasure. Because if I'm Krishna's, then everything that is mine also becomes Krishna's, naturally. So the renunciation and detachment of a devotee is completely natural. Unnatural detachment is when you're pushing something away by your intelligence. You know it's the best thing, so you push it away by your intelligence or by the strength of your mind. But there's always a force going in the opposite direction that I want it for me. But when one actually is in a surrendered position, then his renunciation is natural, and that natural renunciation is called by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu Vairagya Vidya or Yukta Vairagya. It means that everything Nirbandha Krishna Sambandha, everything is in Sambandha in relationship to Krishna. That everything is given to Krishna in relationship. So now Krishna summarizes this section in 12 by saying, the steadily devoted soul attains unadulterated peace because he offers the result of his activities to me, to Krishna. Whereas a person who is not in union with the divine, who is greedy for the fruits of his labor, becomes entangled. So I'll read that again. This is the summary of this section. The steadily devoted soul, so the person is steadily devoted to Krishna. That means he has devotion steadily, not like one day I feel like a devotee and the next day I feel like, and I'm devotee, I want to do this, and I'm here today I'm my body and tomorrow I'm a soul, and back and forth. So we sort of drive ourselves crazy a bit like that. But the steadily devoted soul, he attains unadulterated peace. What does unadulterated mean?
Pure.
Yes. Means complete. There is no other substance added to his peace, such as misery and fretting, worrying. He's actually peaceful because he's steadily devoted. And in this world where it's so hard to find peace, this is in one sense, like in the end of the chapter, in the last verse, one of the last verses of the chapter is what Prabhupada called the peace formula. Bhoktaram Jagatapasam, 29 is the last verse. Bhoktaram Jagatapasam Savaloka Maheshwaram Suridam Savabhutanam Gyatvamam. Knowing this, Shanti Mrityati. If you know this formula, you attain peace. And what is the formula? It's the form, the knowledge that makes one steadily devoted. It's knowledge of one's relationship with Krishna. So there are three points. Bhoktaram Jagatapasam. That Krishna is the Bhokta. What does Bhokta mean? The enjoyer. Bhoktaram of what? Jagatapasam. You're doing something to gain something. Of course, this is spoken in the Vedic context where you're performing a sacrifice. So jagya means sacrifice. So all sacrifice and austerity, and everyone performs sacrifices and austerities continually. What's an example of a sacrifice and austerity you did today? Huh? Yeah, why not? What do you say? Yes, that's the kind of thing we're talking about. One gets out of bed, but who is supposed to enjoy this? So what austerities did you do today? Let's hear about everyone's austerities and tapasyas and sacrifices.
Not really.
You didn't do any today. Did you go anywhere?
No, I'm investing so much of this money in my account.
Well, how about today? You were just talking.
Today is twofold, and I have to make up.
You also, I guess everyone had to do that today, huh? It's so cold. So you went to work, and then you had to deal with your boss, right?
Yeah,
he's okay? He didn't beat you today?
No.
But you sacrificed your time. You had to travel. It's an austerity to get there because you wanted to get something. You wanted to get something. No one does anything without getting it, without getting something. So Krishna says, Bhoktaram Jagatapasam, for all sacrifices. You sacrificed your time. You did something that you didn't feel like doing to get something else. Tapasya, austerity. But Krishna, Bhoktaram, Krishna says that I am the enjoyer of all these things, that we do these things instead of for me, for Krishna. And why? The next line, Sarva Loka Maheshwaram. that he's the, of all the planets, he is the Maha Ishvara, the supreme controller. So this point that to do sacrifices and austerities for him because he's the supreme controller, that's okay, that sounds right. But the third line brings in the sweetness of bhakti more, because it's suridam sarvabhutanam. Sarvabhutanam means of all living entities, that he is the surit. What does surit mean? It means, you know the meaning? What is, you know? Surit. Yeah. Su, rit. Rit means the heart. Su means near the heart. Suridam. He's the heart, the close to the heart friend of all living entities. So then it makes sense. Not only is he the controller of everything, but he's the dearmost friend of everyone. And to do austerities and work for and for just someone because he's the supreme controller, it's like having a heavy boss, that you can't be peaceful unless you work for me. And if he's like that, so okay, you do it because you have to. But when if actually he's the surit, the dearmost friend, and then he is, not only is he your dearmost friend, but he's the supreme controller of everything. Now, who wouldn't like to have a dearmost friend who's the supreme controller of everything? What do you think? What do you think? Would you like to have a friend who's like, has unlimitedly wealthy, unlimitedly powerful, unlimitedly, well, would you or not? Let's get honest here. Yeah, why? Why? Why would you like to have a friend like that?
Feel secure, protected.
Yeah, well, no, as they say in Australia, no worries. And he loves you. He loves you. And he's the supreme. And naturally, you want to, he's going to take care of you. And you naturally, because he loves you and you love him, so you want to be with him and work for him and do what you do for him. This is your offering to him. This is your part. This is your part in the relationship. His part is his part, but that's in a relationship, there's always two parts. And usually in a relationship, and what makes relationships difficult, is that we usually think of what the other person should be doing. And our mind is always focused on what they should be doing. And they're never doing enough for us, according to our estimation. And that's a perfect way to make a relationship awful. So instead of that, we recommend everyone should keep their mind on their own part of the relationship and do it properly. So even with Krishna, especially with Krishna, probably think about, you know, we have a long list of all the things that he should be doing that he's not doing the way we want. But instead of that, the recommendation is we should take our part and keep our mind on our part of the relationship. And Krishna has said here, so gyatvamam, knowing this, suridam sarvabhutanam, gyatvamam shantim richati, one gets complete, achieves perfect peace. Shantim proper translates as relief from material pangs. So in the verse that we were actually reading, was the steadily devoted soul attains the same point, unadulterated, complete peace, because of the depth and completeness of his devotion to Krishna, because he offers the results of his activities to me, and he does that because he's steadily devoted. Whereas a person who is not in union with the divine has no connection with Krishna, with the Supreme. So this is the connection that we have with Krishna, that we are his And it's eternal relationship, and we serve Him. We're surrendered to Him. That's our connection with the Supreme. And a person, and that's our union. Union meaning our yoga or connection. This is the connecting principle. It's bhakti. It's not the force of the same force that applies why we go to work. But it's because this is the nature of the relationship and the nature of the person that we want to please Him. So a person who is not in union with the Divine, who is greedy for the fruits of his labor, becomes entangled. So that's the summary of the last section. When the embodied being, moving on to the next section, but quite similar, when the embodied living being, sarva kamani manasa sanyas yaste sukham vasi nava dvare pure dehi nava korvan nakarayan, when the embodied living being controls his nature and mentally renounces all actions, he resides happily in the city of nine gates, the material body, neither working nor causing work to be done. So we'll read from Prabhupada's purport here. The embodied soul lives in the city of nine gates. So again, these are the principles, the foundational principles of Krishna consciousness that we're supposed to take and apply to our lives according to. Of course, it's elevated, but we should understand clearly what the principles are, and we apply them according to our capacity, our advancement. So when the embodied living being controls his nature and mentally renounces all actions, he resides happily in the city of nine gates, the material body, neither working nor causing work to be done. Gopas purport. The embodied soul lives in the city of nine gates. The activities of the body, or the figurative city of body, are conducted automatically by its particular modes of nature. It's such a concept that's so different from what they teach us in school. That it's going on automatically. That is somewhat taught in school, because no one knows how the body goes on. It's not consciously going on by my desires, and the eyes aren't. I open my eyes and I can see, and my heart is beating. But these and the food is being digested, and I sort of will myself to raise my hand or stand up, but the actual way it happens. I mean, if you peeled away like this, not, we don't recommend you doing this, but if you like peel off the skin and you watch the incredible interplay of muscles, what does it take to do a simple thing like this? It's amazing how many muscles in the shoulder and the arm and your back muscles and your stomach muscles, just to do the simplest thing. And we're not aware of the mechanics of this at all. We just say, okay, I'm going to raise my hand, so we have our part in it. But there's such an incredible arrangement that's taken to do the simplest things that we take for granted. And then there's the things that we don't even think about, like everyone is, I can see it, but you can't see it. You're all blinking. Why? You know, the blinking is required for the eyes, and the heartbeat and the breathing, all the things that we're not conscious of, the circling of the blood in the body, and the interaction between the lungs and the oxygen and the cells, and all this goes on, and we're not at all aware of it. So when the embodied living being, that means the soul within the body, controls his nature and mentally renounces all actions, realizing that I'm not the one doing this. And not only that, the particular nature I have, it isn't me. it's not exactly me, even though I think I'm the one who can do this, and I'm the one who can do that. But it's not exactly me. I'm sort of born in a situation, and it's sort of just, I develop into this person, but I'm not causing my development, actually. I have a particular nature, and I sort of just sort of grow into it, and I take it for granted that's me, but this is actually under the control of the three modes of material nature. And they're under the control of material energy, and that's under the control of Krishna. So when the embodied soul lives in the city of nine gates, and the activities of the body, or the figurative city of body, are conducted automatically by its particular modes of nature. The soul, although subjecting himself to the conditions of the body, can be beyond those conditions. Now that, when you're really in your body, in identifying with the body, that's inconceivable. You can be beyond that. But there are great personages who have completely detached themselves from their body. Like when you're reading Chaitanya Charitamrita, it's in the seventh chapter of Madhyalila. When Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was traveling in, he started traveling in South India, and he went to Koma Tetra, and he stayed at one Brahmin's house in Koma, and then after he left the city, there was another Brahmin in that city who was a great soul. His name was Vasudev, but he had leprosy, and he had worms living in his body. Now, he had no identification with the body, and when the worms would fall out off, what would he do? He would pick them up and put them back. Now, just think about that for a second. Like, but worms, like, living in your body, and just the thought of a worm living in my body, uninvited, you know, it makes you sick almost, practically speaking. But then he falls out, the worm falls out, one of the many worms, and you pick him up and put him back in. You don't want to displace him from his home. I mean, it's inconceivable, practically speaking, for someone who's in bodily consciousness, because what are the worms eating when they're in your body? They're eating meat. And still. So this is quite inconceivable, isn't it? And it's in fact, it's repulsive for the material mind. Is that only me who's repulsed by it? When, if you think about it, it's terrible. Because you put yourself in that.